give me some time to receive the message of being free.
Hey everybody, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Lisa and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the Napa Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeaker.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So I had met this lovely lady when I was at another meeting, her home group, scoping out some good speakers. And it was suggested that I ask Rebecca to come tell her story. So I'll give you Rebecca.
Hey, everybody. This is the first podium I can actually see over. My name's Rebecca. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. So thank you for having me. It's always an honor to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, so it truly is an honor to be here. My sobriety date is November the 3rd, 2019. I have a home group. It is the Fifth Tradition group, and we meet Tuesday on Zoom. We have a Thursday big book study and a Saturday night speaker meeting. So if you're ever around town and want to come see us, we'd love to have you. I have a sponsor. She's absolutely perfect for me, and I sponsor a bunch of women all over the country, which I'll talk about when I get to how it's like now. All right, so what it was like. I'm going to talk just a little bit about my childhood, not much, just because I know I have 40 minutes. Just a couple of things that are important. I do want to say that the way that I see my childhood now is very different from how I saw my childhood growing up and even before I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was truly a victim to my circumstances and believed that all the things that happened to me when I was young were the reason why I was an alcoholic. I grew up in a pretty volatile home. I had a dad who was a heavy drinker. I thought he was an alcoholic, but he was not actually an alcoholic. But he got very volatile when he drank. And so I just remember that set up a lot of fear. In addition to that, I started getting abused sexually, physically and emotionally from the ages of 6 to 12 by both men and women. And the reason that's important is because at the age of 14, because of the abuse, I came out as a lesbian. And even though that's no longer my story, which there's nothing wrong with being a lesbian, it's just no longer my story, something major happened to me with my family. My mom was very religious, and she believed that I would go to hell for being gay. So they disowned me at that time from the family. They said I was no longer welcome in the family if I was going to be a lesbian, and that I needed to change. And so she would leave Bible verses on my bed. And what that did, not only did it make me feel like I didn't have my parents' love, but it made me feel like I didn't have God's love. So from that moment on, I wanted nothing to do with anything or anyone that believed in God, and that made AA really hard for me, and I'll talk about how I got to finding God when I get to what it's like now. So, growing up, I was pretty just always depressed. I was a fun kid at first, but then I think some of the things that started happening changed my personality. So, I just remember being really young and writing, like, really dark poetry at, like, 11 or 12, just very, very depressing. And I thought all my problems back then were because of the things that happened to me. What I believe to be true now is that we talk about alcoholism being a three-part disease. It's spiritual, physical, and mental. And the spiritual malady, the book describes it as restless, irritable, and discontent. And I thought my restless, irritable, and discontent was because of the things that I went through, which I'm sure they did make me restless and irritable discontent. But the truth is, I spent years and years in therapy. I started going to therapy. My parents started taking me at 12 years old. And I continued therapy probably until my 40s, until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, let me say, I'm not saying that therapy is not good, because I think therapy got me where I needed to be in regards to some of the trauma stuff that happened to me, and I think it was very important to get me where I was. But the truth is, it did not touch my alcoholism. And I thought that if I got enough therapy and I fixed all the things that happened to me, that I would then be able to drink successfully. And that's just not my story. So I started drinking at 14. I had my first drink. I had vodka and orange juice, which I could no longer drink orange juice. But from the minute that I started drinking, when we talk about alcoholism, we talk about an allergy of the body, right? And the way that looks, I believe I had that allergy as soon as I took my first drink, because I don't remember setting out to just have one or two because I had never drank, but I drank into a blackout. And that was kind of my story with drinking from the very beginning. So I drank into a blackout. My brother was chasing me around the house with a knife, which that's a whole other story. And then I called the cops. So the cops come. I got court ordered to AA at 14. So I remember, I think it was Howe Place, actually, that I went to. And I remember going in there as a bunch of old men smoking cigarettes, and I was like, what a bunch of losers. It's like hindsight's 20/20, because here I am. So I had no clue that I really had a problem or was even close to doing anything about it. So my drinking continued. The way that my life looked, it was just lots of drinking. I was on my own. For the first time, it was about 15 years old. Then I came home for a little bit, and then I was out on my own fully at 17. So I just drank really recklessly. I never really felt like I wanted to be alive, so I always had a death wish, and so I drank that way. I would drink in excess, again, not realizing that I had a phenomenal craving and that I had an allergy. But I would do things like I would jump out of a moving car on 75. I remember going down the interstate and just grabbing the wheel. I wasn't driving, just grabbing the wheel, and we were like spinning like this with cars heading straight for us. Just no desire to be here. So every time that I drank, I would set out to usually have like three or four and then overshoot the mark. So in my drinking career, I ended up, let's see, I held somebody at gunpoint in a blackout, which, let me say, these are consequences of my drinking. They're not what made me an alcoholic. But I happened to be a really mean drunk because I had a lot of anger from my childhood. And it just happened to come out when I drank. So I got drunk. I held somebody at gunpoint with a loaded gun from Atlanta all the way to Rome. It was like, give me one reason why I shouldn't pull the trigger. I ended up going to jail. Every single one, I've been to jail 9 times when I've drank. All of it, I always had a simple battery charge because I get very violent. And then finally, when I started landing in jail, I'm like, I remember one time I woke up in jail. I think it was probably like the 6th time that I was in jail. And I woke up and somebody was rubbing my head. And I was like, who is that? And she was like, I said, where am I? She said, honey, you in jail. I said, again? So I don't know how I kept landing in jail. Like, it started to become concerning because one minute I'm drinking and the next minute I'm waking up in jail again. So throughout this time, by the age of 17, I had dropped out of high school. I had become a stripper. I had about 4 suicide attempts. So I was in mental institutes. I was in 13th floor of Grady. Drinking was always involved in any of my suicide attempts. So by the time I was, 17, I was dancing. And then I went to jail for the 10th time. So when we talk about alcoholism also, I did not realize that I had lost power of choice in drinking. So when I came to AA the first time, so I want to kind of talk about my experience in AA, because I actually was in AA twice. In 2000, I realized that I had a problem. But I wasn't clear on what alcoholism was. So my dad was dying at that time. I had gone to jail, and I remember I was in jail, and I knocked on the door, and I said, hey, I think I need help. And they came over, and they gave me the number to AA, and they were like, you should go check out these meetings. So I was also very dependent on relationships. So from 14 to 40, I was just as addicted to relationships as I was alcohol, if not worse. So there was no break in relationships. So at that time, I was dating women. And I had a girlfriend that was in AA, and I remember I went to Galano Club for the first time in 2000. I don't remember ever seeing big books. I'm sure there were some there. But I was purely staying sober because the girl I was dating was sober. But it was my first introduction into AA, and I think I stayed sober for like 9 months with no program. And then, actually it was almost a year, because I remember walking into the bar, and it was as easy as that. After having all that time sober, I walked straight to the bar and I was like, give me a shot. And boom, I was off to the races. Looking back now, I understand why. Because I was doomed to drink again no matter what. And so after that, I started drinking again. Again, more suicide attempts. Every time I drank again, I had the allergy. I drank more than I intended to drink every single time. It didn't matter if I had a job. I went through millions of jobs. I think I had 300 jobs we added up. More like 250. 250 jobs by the time I was 30. Because I would just pull my life down on to the ground and then I would crawl my way out. I was notorious for being really good at building my life back up. And they talk about that in the third step. You know, the third step talks about how we are the actor trying to run the show. And that we are self-will, we're in riot, though we don't usually think so. Well, that was me. Because I was pretty good at doing things, but I made it a lot harder on myself. So again, kept drinking. I didn't really want to be alive, so doing AA was kind of hard, because it's like, if you don't want to be alive, what does it really matter? But what was happening behind the scenes is all the therapy I was doing wasn't helping my alcoholism, but it was helping me to keep my feet moving. And it was helping me deal with some of that other stuff. And so, again, I was realized I had a drinking problem. So in 2012, I was introduced to the Fifth Tradition Group in Atlanta, who's my home group now. And I remember every time I saw God on the wall, I was immediately like, I can't do this. Because I was an atheist. I didn't literally, if you told me you were religious or that you believed in a God, it's like we agnostics. I was violently anti-religious. Like, I could think you were attractive, and if you told me you believed in God, then you were unattractive. Like, that's how, what an aversion I had to anybody believing in anything bigger than themselves. And I had a false illusion of power, too, because I was on my own for so young, just surviving. So I came into Fifth, and I wanted to do what they did, but I really didn't believe I had to do what they had to do. Because the truth is, I didn't really understand what being an alcoholic was. I saw people that were happy and doing good, but I saw the steps on the wall, and I'm like, yeah, I don't need to do that. Again, I did not understand what alcoholism was. And while I was in the tradition, I was still taking pain pills. They were prescribed, but I didn't really need them. And I would overtake them sometimes. So I remember just pushing through the steps, not really believing I needed to be doing this, not believing that my life depended on it, kind of in and out, not really showing up, not doing service. I remember people would be like, you need to put money in the basket. I'm like, for what? I need that money. What if I need a coffee? Like, I was so selfish and self-centered. Like, you should set up chairs. Why would I do that? Somebody else can set up chairs. So just completely missing the boat. But what happened was I was taking pills, and I remember going through the steps, and I got to 9. And when you're on 6 and 7, it basically asks you to sit for an hour and ask, have you skimped on anything? And I'm like, or have you been honest? And I'm like, well, I have been taking pain pills, but let's see if I can, like, beat the system. So I'm great at beating the system. And so I remember having a moment where I was like, this probably won't work for me because of that, but I'm going to keep going anyway. And one of the things that I had done I had run a girlfriend over with a car on purpose to kill her. And so my sponsor at the time was like, you get to fly to Michigan and make an amends to the girl you ran over. Now, I had outrun the statute of limitations on the whole lawsuit she's trying to sue me, so I was out of the clear, right? She's like, no, you get to go to Michigan and you get to let her sue you. And I remember thinking, I don't know if I should do this because I'm taking pain pills. And I don't think this is going to work. But I'll tell you why I'm grateful for that in a second. So I went and I made the amends, and she sued me, and I drank again. And I stayed out for a while because I had sworn off AA, too. I had a resentment against AA. I don't really know why, but I did because they were trying to tell me the truth, and I didn't want to hear it. That's why. Because I was still the victim to my past. And so what happened was I kept drinking like I always do. I ended up going to jail again. I did a geographical move. That's another thing I love to do is move. I think I've lived in 50 different places in different states and in the same state. I just moved. And so I had moved to Colorado. And I remember having a moment. Colorado was the first place that I felt like there was something bigger than me. Just the majestic mountains and like I just my soul felt like so alive there. And I remember hiking, and I remember this voice. It wasn't an auditory voice, but this inner voice was like, you need to stop drinking. And I remember saying that, I know, but I don't want to. I'm not ready. And so I kept drinking, but the strange thing was I actually started to get better in a lot of ways. Like I was no longer suicidal, and this is why I think the therapy helped me with the things it needed to help me with. I was no longer suicidal. I learned how to keep my feet moving if I was depressed. And so I was getting up. I used to lay in bed for weeks at a time, and I'm not doing that anymore. So I started wanting to live, but yet I was still an alcoholic. And so that was confusing because I thought, well, I'm getting better. Why am I still drinking more than I want to drink, and why do I keep drinking when I say I'm going to stop? And so I drank again. With all the stuff that happened in my drinking career, it was really nothing tragic. I just remember I drank, and the next day I said, if my mom dies or my dog dies, I have absolutely no tools to be different, and I will kill myself. And the walls started closed again. And in that moment, I was like, I have to do something different. And so I picked up the phone, and I looked for, the only thing I needed to do was look for like rehab or sober living, because I was never willing to do that before. And so I found a sober living that kind of did therapy or rehab, whatever, and decided I would go talk to them. A part of me was like, why don't you just go home? But I knew in that moment, I said, if you go home, it's going to be the same thing it always is, and you're going to end up in the same cycle. You've got to do this here. And so I packed up all my stuff, had my dog in the car, went to the sober living. They were like, yes, you can come. And I had to pay like $150. And I was like, well, I have to go back to Atlanta, have to take my dog, drop her off, and then drive back. And they're like, she's never coming back. They love to tell this story because they're like, there is no way this chick is coming back. I sure did. I drove my dog because I was so broken down. And I just, for the first time, we talk about grace. I had grace where I was like, I have to do this no matter what. So I drove my dog to Atlanta, dropped her off, and drove all the way back to Colorado in a 24-hour period. And that was the beginning of the rest of my life. So what happened when I got there was I remember another moment where I was laying in bed with a bunch of girls. I'm like 44 at the time. I'm like, this is the dumbest idea I've ever had. Like, what is being in this place with these girls gonna help? How is this gonna help me? Like, this is so stupid. It was like that whole talking myself back out of what I've just done. And I remember the thought came, just trust the process. Just trust the process and be quiet. Because that's when I, like, run again, right? Because it doesn't make sense how this is going to work. And it wasn't even the sober living that got me sober. It was the willingness to go to the sober living that propelled me into getting sober. I needed to do something that made me uncomfortable. And I also didn't ever want to have to be in another sober living again with girls stealing my Oreos and all the other stuff that comes along with it at 44. So when I was in the sober living, I actually was doing more than anybody else was doing. And this is where I was so grateful for Fifth Tradition and why I'm so excited to be back with this group. Everything that they had taught me that they thought was lost on me came back in that moment. And so I remember I had a sponsor, and I was writing out my four steps. I was going to meetings every day, and she's like, you need to slow down. You're going way too fast. Like, you're not even going to sponsor until you have 2 years sober. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I know that's not right. And if I wait for 2 years to sponsor or slow down on the steps, I'm going to die. And so I was 4 months sober, and boom, COVID hit. So I was in Colorado, and I was like, I am not going to stay here during COVID. I'm going to go home. And so I got in my car, and I drove home, and then we went to Charleston to see one of my brothers. And I remember I was in the car, and I was like, if something doesn't happen, I'm going to drink again. I knew it in my gut. I'm like, I'm in trouble if something doesn't happen. And I picked up my phone, and I just put on an AA speaker, and it happened to be her. It happened to be Chris Raymer. If anybody knows Chris Raymer. And he was talking about powerlessness in step one. And I'm telling you, when this guy was speaking, it was like he was speaking to me. And in that moment, it was like everything made sense. He explained alcoholism in a way where for the first time in my life, I was afraid. Like, I was never afraid of drinking before because I didn't understand what alcoholism was. I didn't know that I had a fatal illness. And I didn't know that I had lost the power of choice in drinking because it always felt to me like I made a decision to stop drinking and then I changed my mind, right? So when I heard him talk, I was like, I have to get in touch with this man immediately. And my mom was in the car. She said she could see it on my face. It just, everything clicked. And so I reached out to him and he changed the trajectory of my life. He put me in touch with a group called Primary Purpose in Austin. And I got a sponsor, and I started doing these steps very fast. And I think for me, I had to do the work like that because I was so sick. And the reason I say, by the way, that I'm a recovered alcoholic is because I think it's super important for the new people to know that we don't have to stay sick. Because when I got here, I was very, very sick. And when we say recovered, we're talking about a hopeless state of mind and body. And I'm clear that I'm going to stay recovered of those two things as long as I show up here and do service or I continue to do the steps. If I stop doing that, I will immediately become unrecovered. But you don't have to stay sick. You can get better. So, again, I did the steps really fast. For me, it kept me removed enough from me that I could get busy. So I'll kind of take you through the steps, how it was then, and some of how it is now. So step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. There's a hyphen, so that's one statement. Powerless for me is synonymous with allergy. So I have a body that doesn't break down alcohol properly. As soon as I take alcohol in my system, I develop a phenomenon of craving that's going to demand that I drink more than I intend to drink. Oh, this makes sense. This is why when I set out to have two, I drink eight. Or 10, or 12, almost every time. Now, the book does say that there are certain times that we can bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering of a week or a month ago. So there's certain times, some people have more times than I had, where I'm able to have just a few. And see, those are the times that I was like, see, I'm not an alcoholic. Because remember that one time in 1982 when I drank two? But inevitably, even if I can just drink a few, one to two to three times, there is always going to be that time behind it where I'm going to overshoot the mark. Normal drinkers, they don't have that problem. So I got real clear on that, the first part of step one. Second part, we admitted our lives had become unmanageable. I used to think that the unmanageability was losing the cars, losing the job, losing the houses, but that's not the case. That's not what they're talking about, because if that was true, what about the woman that's a millionaire that's never lost anything that's died of alcoholism sitting in the rooms? They're talking about being unable to manage my thoughts around alcohol. And this is the hard part for me because, again, I told you I thought that I knew that I made a decision to stop drinking and then I changed my mind. So it was real important that I got with a sponsor and I went through this book and we talked about loss of choice, because I did not believe that I had lost the power of choice. And so I had to really sit with my experience. And the best example I can give of that was the last time I went to jail, I was so devastated. I was like, I will never do this again. The judge let me out of my own recognizance. I'm like, yes, don't worry. I'll pee in the cup. I will not drink again. It's never going to happen. And this was November, okay, 2018. Fast forward to December, right? I'm restless, irritable, discontent, and I need a drink. But I don't know that's what's happening. I don't even understand what the spirituality is. And I said to a friend, you know what, I haven't been called for a UA, I guarantee you they're going to call me, but I need a drink. So I even said, I'm going to probably go to jail for a year, and I drank anyway. And that is losing the power of choice, because why would any sane person, right, but I can't tell the truth from the false with drinking, because that seems normal. And once I really saw, oh my God, I'm insane and I don't even know it, that scared me. Because I never knew that. I could be insane and think I'm sane. So, step one. Step two. Now we're getting into the God thing, right? Well, I'm clear on step one. So, once I knew I had a fatal illness, so I'm unable to manage my thoughts around drinking. So that means I have a mind that's going to lead me to the first and a body that demands that I have the second, whether I want it or not. And those two things are what make it a fatal illness. That scared me enough to propel me through the rest of the steps. So step two, I just had to know, because I knew I was insane, I knew I needed a power greater than myself. And that power for me at first was only 1 inch more powerful than me only. I call that power God now. I did not call it God when I was on step two. Step three, okay, now we're talking about turning our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. No, thank you. I'm thinking I'm going to be in a muumuu passing out Jesus pamphlets. No offense if y'all do that, but that's not what I saw for my life. And I'm like, I do not want to be, I'm never going to be able to cuss. I'm going to have to wear, like, slacks all the time. I just pictured this, I don't know. It was not what it is. But thank God for good sponsorship, because what step three was about was me being clear that me trying to run the show, like the stage character we talk about, is not a success. Now that took me a minute because I thought that I was successful. So I had to really go through that with a sponsor and see how am I always trying to get my way where even my motives are good, I'm like stepping on the toes of my fellows. So step three for me was less about faith and more about self-doubt. As long as I was clear that me running the show on my own was not good, I had done a solid step three, which was good for someone like me because remember I'm an atheist. So that didn't have a lot to do with God. And my power is only 1 inch more powerful than me only at this point. Step four was super powerful for me because I had been a victim my entire life. And so when I did step four, the most powerful part of step four to me was the third column. Because, you know, when the book talks about it, it's just like, did it affect our self-esteem, our ambition, our pride? It's like, no explanation. Check, check. I don't know. Let's just put them all down so I get them right. And then when I did the work this time with my sponsor, it was like, we broke down, what does it mean for this resentment to affect your self-esteem? Well, that means how I value myself, okay? So now what I'm looking at is how these resentments cause me to have these beliefs, right, about myself. And now I'm going into the world with these beliefs, and I'm causing harm to people, right? And that was powerful for me because I can tell you that today, almost all of my problems come from my third column. I am unlovable. I am not worthy. You will not disrespect me. All those old ideas that I've gotten out of these resentments are where I'm operating from me. So it was very important that I got clear on that. And then the fourth column, disregard the other person entirely. Where am I at fault? You know, I have a mom who... we couldn't even talk on the phone without me screaming at her and hanging up. And I now am best friends with her. We travel. And the fifth step is what gave me that. I had a sponsor that was showing me things from an entirely different angle. And she's like, hey, Rebecca, is it possible that even though your mom disowned you for being gay, she maybe really believes that you were going to go to hell for being gay because of her religion? Is that possible? Yeah, it's possible. Can you imagine how scary that must be? To think that your daughter is going to go to hell and really believe that. So she's taking me out of myself and putting me in her position. And so now I'm seeing my mom through compassionate eyes. She wasn't trying to cause me harm, but yet I have this belief that I'm unlovable. It had nothing to do with me. It never had anything to do with me. And now I'm going in the world thinking I'm unlovable. That's dishonest, and that's not true. And so talk about getting free. That work freed me at a level I never thought that was possible for me. Six and seven, you know, I did exactly as the book describes. I went home. I sat with the work that I had done on the inventory, looked at my defects. I wrote out the first 5 steps. Am I clear on step 1? How do I know I'm clear on step 1? What are my actions show? Step 2, am I clear on step 2? How do I know I'm clear on step 2? I wrote all of that out. And then I got with my defects. And, you know, the truth is I have a lot of defects, anger being one of them, that has been very powerful for me. And it worked when I was young. It kept you away from me, and it kept you scared of me. And then it stopped serving me. But it's a hard one for me to let go of because it is powerful. And sometimes it does what I want it to do, even though it's not what it should be doing. But so the book says, you know, for the character defects that we're not willing to have removed, we pray until we are willing or until we're able or God's ready to take them. God's obviously not ready to take my anger because you'll hear that story in a second. So 6 and 7, sat with that. 8 and 9. You know, when I made the list, again, I was grateful for Fifth Tradition because I really believe 8 and 9 is where the rubber meets the road at AA and where you can tell the difference between people really doing this work and people maybe not. And I don't mean that judgmental. But the truth is, it's like made a list of all persons we had harmed. How many is all? Well, all is how free do you want to be? And the book says, I remember I used to think it was only because of drinking. I don't know where I got that because it doesn't say that. But it says that we're making amends for self-will and manipulation. Well, that's almost everyone I've come in contact with. So my list is long, and it keeps getting longer. I can drive down the road. I'm like, yep, you stole from them. Write that down. Or through sponsorship, they're like, oh, I committed a fraud. I was like, today? No, not today. And then I'm like, oh, I committed fraud too. During COVID, sober. Oh, I got to write that down, right? So made a list of all persons we had harmed. So I make that list, and again, it continues to grow. And then made direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure others. This has been a powerful process for me. The promises came true for me quickly. A couple of the most powerful amends stories, I'll just tell you how God has worked, which I think is so cool. A couple times there was a people on my list and I was like, I cannot imagine making an amends to this person. Like, I just was like almost sweating even thinking about it. Like, and then I was like, oh, well, you have like 1,682,000, so just put them at the bottom. And so I wrote them down at the bottom, was like, I'll just go through all these other ones. Literally, I had not talked to this person since 2010. As soon as I wrote him on the list, I woke up the next day to a Facebook friend request from the same guy. I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. So I was like, okay, can I ignore this? Nope, I can't ignore it. So I messaged him, boom, made the amends. Then there was another amends that I needed to make to one of my first girlfriends, and it was bringing up a lot of the old past stuff, and I was like, oh, I do not want to make this amends. It was just another one of those where I'm just like, I do not want to have to do this. Same thing. Literally, the next day, I wake up to a Facebook message. We haven't even talked since the 90s. We're not friends on Facebook. I got a message from her on Messenger. This is how God works. If I show up, and if I am willing, God will give me what I need in the moment that I need it, but not a second before. And I'm so glad to have learned that, because that's been my experience, and I can hold on to that for hard times, that, you know, because that's another story I'll get to in a second. Okay, so amends. Another thing I want to say about amends. You know, my sponsor has me write out a letter, and then I read it to her for approval. And the reason she does that is because when I first started writing the amends, it was like, I'm sorry that I didn't get myself help sooner. And she's like, oh, that's cute. No. How about I'm sorry for being a train wreck and running through your entire life with no disregard for you at all? And I'm like, ew. But that's a very different amends process, right? We also have a question in our amends that I really like that we do, and it's, when we go through the list of the harms that we've done, I will say to them, I think that I know how this affected you, but I would like you to take the opportunity to tell me how this affected you. And I'm going to tell you guys, it has been a game changer for me seeing myself clearly. So one of the things that I got back was painful but important. I had an ex-girlfriend that I beat up. I beat everybody up. So to me, it's like, yeah, you got beat up. Big deal. I know that sucks, but I mean, I'm so like, what's the word? Just detached from it, right? Because that's just always what I did. Like, yeah, I beat you up. Sorry. So I'm going through it. She goes, remember when you beat me up and left me outside the bar? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, well, I had to call my friends to come and get me. And six of her friends came to pick her up. And they did an intervention on her, and they said, if you don't leave Rebecca, we are no longer going to be your friend because she is going to kill you, and we're afraid for your life. And man, did that stop me in my tracks, because I was like, whoa, right? That's very different than, oh, I just beat you up. And so even though it's difficult to hear, it's super important. I have another friend who I ran her credit through the mud, had her pay for a bunch of stuff, right? And I'm thinking, yeah, she's mad because I ruined her credit. Well, you shouldn't have co-signed for me. Duh. And so I get to that part. I didn't say that in the men's, but I get to the part where I ask, you know, how have I affected you? And she said, you know, what bothers me the most is all the time that you said, oh, I got a new job. I'm going to be able to pay you more. And you never paid me more. I wish you would have just never said that. See, I would have never known that if I wouldn't have asked that question. What did that teach me? That I need to be impeccable with my word, right? I wouldn't know that if I had to ask that question. So I'm grateful for the amends process and the way I've been taught. And then I've got to left 5 minutes. Okay. 10 and 11. I love 10 and 11 because I'm pretty sick. Like, they talk about some of us are sicker than others and we have to do a lot in AA. I'm that person, unfortunately and fortunately. But 10 really keeps me on the beam. When I'm doing 10, I always make sure that I'm doing a 10, because to me it's like a mini fifth step, right? So I'm watching for four things. And when, not if, these crop up, which means they will, I am to do four things. And I'm supposed to pray to have it removed, confess it to another person, make an amends promptly, and turn my thoughts resolutely to someone I can help. The thing is, if I have a 10, right, and I'm mad at you because you're an idiot and you don't know what you're doing, and so I'm asking God, please remove my anger because he's stupid and doesn't know what he's doing, that's very different than when I call my sponsor and she's like, hey, I get that you're upset, but aren't you expecting someone to be different than what they are? And they've shown you who they are. You keep trying to fit your way and get them to do what you want them to do, and now you're all bothered by it. So really the fault is yours because you can't accept people as they are. So now the prayer I'm going to God is very different than save me from them being stupid. It's God, please help me accept people as they are and not have unrealistic expectations on people. I would love to tell you that I'm great at 10. I'm not all the time. I told you about my anger the other day, and I work a pretty strong program. I mean, I do most things in AA. But I am not perfect. The other day I had a mechanic, and he hit that third column, you will not disrespect me, right? I'm screaming at a mechanic in a bathing suit in the middle of a apartment complex. Every profanity that you can think of. A vein popping out of my neck. You would think I had never even walked into the rooms of AA as I'm doing this. It never even dawned on me that I need to pray or do a 10 step. It's like I have this hood side of me, and then I have the AA side. And when this side comes out, it's going to be a minute. And so I was literally even messaging Melissa, just, I'm still just cussing. And I remember it took me a good, I'd say, 24 hours where I even said, I think I owe an amends, but I'm not making it because I'm justified, right? But then I'm helping a girl. A girl calls me, and I'm telling her, oh, it sounds like you're in your third column, and you're maybe you think that you're, you know, you're being disrespected. And I'm like, wait a second, isn't that what just happened to you? And I was like, dang it. I got to make an amend. And so this is where I'm grateful for my step one, because if I wasn't clear that my life depended on this work, I would have gone back and made an amends to that guy. But I went face to face because I was pretty angry, and I did an amends face to face because I know if I don't do that, and if I choose, knowing I need to do it, I choose not to, then I'm probably going to drink again. And then lastly, I just want to talk about, I didn't get to talk about 11, but I do like to do a written premeditation of my day to see where I'm going to be selfish, dishonest, or self-seeking. It helps me kind of stay grounded. I did not do one that morning. That's how that spiraled out of control. But then sponsoring other women, to me, sponsorship is probably one of the most important things for my program because it keeps me in the work. Because if I'm telling my sponsee, you need to make an amends, and then I'm screaming at people and not making an amends, I'm a hypocrite. And walking them through this journey removes me enough from me that God can come in and work on all the problems that I think I have. And even if they don't get fixed, the perception gets fixed. So I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful. I try to keep at least 2 to 3 people in the book, because if I don't, my program will start to slide, and I just can't risk that. Thank you for letting me share, and I appreciate you all being here. Thank you. That was really, really honest. Awesome. Appreciate it. We've asked a friend to hand out the chips.
Hey, I'm Billy. I'm an addict. Hey, Billy. Here at NABA, we have a chip system to celebrate our victories in sobriety. We start with a white chip if you're just coming back in or just starting a way of life.
Of being free. Give me some time to breathe. It's not that I don't want to see. I misunderstood your words to go ahead and forget my world. Oh, and I surrender, that even darkness could be a light. Oh, and I remember that all the dreams are made in the night. And I tell myself not to cry. I feel like a long lost child. It's not by hand.